This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
BC's ambulance paramedics had been struggling to keep up with rising calls, including surges in overdose and mental health calls for years, only to be clobbered by the pandemic. CTV News has learned during the summer the ambulance call center...
This piece is really key to ensuring that we dispatch the right resources to the right patients.
Had as few as 8 call takers for the entire province. So when June's heat dome peaked as 911 was inundated with mass casualties...
That was a night where the ambulance service collapsed. There's no doubt about it. If you speak to my co-workers that worked that night, including myself, it was apocalyptic that night.
Leadership couldn't explain why they hadn't had all hands on deck in light of forecasted record temperatures.
A best of Radio EcoShock replay. That comes from a report by Penny Daflos of CTV News in Vancouver, November 11, 2021. Last summer, the West Coast was slammed with stunning, never-expected heat. The heat dome lasted 3 days. 5 months later, we just found out from a coroner's report, almost 600 people died in the province of British Columbia during that heat emergency, with hundreds more in the United States, especially in Oregon. Those are the low numbers, the direct excess deaths. But human bodies get damaged by extreme heat in ways that disable or kill months and even years later. Our reporting system doesn't pick up that damage, and it can take years for science to catalog the real costs. Like long-haul COVID, there are unknown numbers of long-haul heat victims. According to Harvard's Dr. David Keith, these include babies damaged by heat in the womb, who suffer lower expectations for a lifetime. In the future, heat waves could be as deadly as the current pandemic, but every year in some places. You will hear all that in a few minutes. In British Columbia, as you heard, the ambulance system broke down under the high volume of calls for help. People were collapsing on the street and in their homes. I lived in Vancouver for 25 years and never met anyone with an air conditioner in their home. The people, the government, and the health system was not ready for this breakout of climate change. If the power goes out too, nobody in the developed world is ready. The heat is often laid over drought, leading to massive forest or brush fires, more deaths and damage to health from smoke pollution. People suffer real health damage from such high stress if a community is threatened, forced to evacuate, or burns down, as Lytton, British Columbia did in the summer of 2021. A doctor in the small town of Nelson, B.C., just made world headlines with a diagnosis we all knew was coming. Dr. Kyle Merritt diagnosed a patient suffering a condition he calls climate change. Here is the report from Vancouver CTV News, November 11th.
A BC doctor is making global headlines, being called the first physician ever to diagnose a patient with climate change. As CTV's Binder Sajjan reports, he's hoping it will raise awareness about how global warming is impacting people's health.
Unprecedented wildfires followed by oppressive heat had emergency departments in the Kootenays busy this summer.
It became upsetting, honestly, to see the effects that were happening on people.
When Dr. Kyle Merritt of Nelson saw people coming in with heat stroke, dehydration, as well as breathing issues from wildfire smoke, he decided to address the underlying issues and diagnosed a patient with climate change.
What we're seeing, especially with climate change, is that it's affecting the most vulnerable amongst us. So it's the people that can't afford air conditioning for a variety of reasons, can't escape the smoke, et cetera, have to work outside.
He's part of a group of physicians who on their own time are advocating for planetary health to keep patients safe. Created 2 years ago, the doctors say many people, including young ones, are anxious about the future.
And we're seeing this playing out in many ways. Some of them are losing hope for their future. They're not necessarily seeing that there's a point to going to university, to saving for retirement. And many are even considering whether they want to have kids.
They're talking to policymakers and individuals about solutions. People can change what they eat, how they commute, and heat their homes to help the planet.
And if you do something to contribute, you gain a sense of advocacy, you become part of the solution instead of part of the problem. And that just really helps people.
Dr. Merritt's diagnosis is making headlines around the world, with many outlets picking up the story.
I'm a family doctor in a small town, and certainly I'm not used to this amount of attention that I've been receiving recently over the past couple of days here. It's interesting the way that things, I guess, make an impact.
Binder Sajjan, CTV News, Victoria.
Regular listeners know I have covered the deadly dangers of heat, literally global warming, for years and years. You can get an ebook collection of my interviews with top scientists and doctors. Look for Surviving in the Age of Extreme Heat at ecoshock.org. A new listener sent in a tip about a new podcast that is right on target. Episode 24 of the podcast called Energy versus Climate asks the big question, is heat the greatest climate threat? If you asked me that a couple of years ago, I would have picked crop damage, which can be caused by extreme heat or drought, extreme rains, or even sudden cold snaps. That threatens the food for millions of people. On the longer term, sea level rise will flood coastal cities housing billions of people and key agricultural deltas that feed millions. The Energy versus Climate podcast has a star-studded cast. There are three hosts. The ringmaster on this production is Ed Whittingham. He is a clean energy, policy, and finance consultant, a fellow at the Public Policy Forum, and he works with the Creative Destruction Lab. Whittingham is the former executive director of the Pembina Institute. Following Ed, we hear from Dr. David Keith. David was our guest in 2015 and often comes up in this program. He is a star in the carbon capture and storage game, as well as a solid climate scientist. Rounding out the team is Professor Sarah Hastings Simon from the University of Calgary. She's so sharp. Find links to listen to these great podcasts in my show blog at ecoshock.org, or go straight to energyversusclimate.com. So that's energyvsclimate.com. For this heat threat show, the group invites another repeat Radio EcoShock guest, author Jeff Goodall. His books are bestsellers, including The Water Will Come, Rising Seas, Sinking Cities, and The Remaking of the Civilized World. I talked to him about that book. Now, Jeff is investigating heat impacts for a book to come out next year, and it's about how we die and the cost of damaged infrastructure as record heat pops up around the world. We're looking forward to that. The podcast is well over an hour and worth it all. So we will just hear selections from the podcast in this program. And it's called, Is Heat the Greatest Climate Threat? And we start with this summary of new science from Dr. David Keith.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Season 3, Episode 4, wow. Energy versus Climate. My name is Ed Whittingham, and I'm joined by my webinar co-hosts, Sarah Hastings Simon and David Keith. This past summer, we Canadians experienced a pretty oppressive heat dome, unlike anything that we've experienced before. For most of us, it meant a sweaty week. But for some, hundreds in fact, it was deadly. And as the Globe and Mail reported from June 24th to June 30th, paramedics in BC, the province of BC, responded to 772 cases specifically recorded as heat-related illness. And by comparison, that's 55 times the number logged during the entire month of June 2020, the year before. And in fact, on one night, June 28th, every fire truck in Vancouver was out on medical calls, so not a single station had a truck on hand in case of an actual fire. So that, of course, is nothing for anyone who's read the harrowing opening chapter to Kim Stanley Robinson's book, Ministry for the Future. And while it's a work of fiction, after this summer, it's really not hard to imagine millions dying from heat in equatorial and mid-latitude countries in a world with 1.5, 2, or 3 degrees centigrade of warming. July 2021, by the way, was the world's hottest month ever recorded. So today we ask, is heat the greatest climate threat? And to help us answer that question, we're joined by Jeff Goodall. Jeff is the author of 5 books, including Big Coal, The Dirty Secret Behind America's Energy Future, and The Water Will Come, Rising Seas, Sinking Cities, and the Remaking of the Civilized World, the latter of which was New York Times Critics' Top Book of 2017. Jeff is working on a new book that looks at the impact of heat on humans. Now, that book won't be published for another year, so today we're getting a sneak peek at some of Jeff's findings. He joins us from Austin, Texas. David's going to start with a primer on the epidemiology of heat impacts, Then all of us, the four of us, will chat until 15 minutes past the falling hour, wherever you are in whatever time zone. And after that, we'll get to your questions. You can send them in via the Q&A box throughout the webinar. Please don't use the raise hand function or the chat box. Our producer, Eva, Mika, is otherwise engaged today. So our producer, Eva, will screen for live questioners. And we're recording, as always. So if you don't want to ask your question live and be recorded for posterity, just tell Eva, just say so. All right, David, over to you for the primer.
Thank you. Well, I've been involved, as I said before, in the show for 30 years or so in climate. And during most of that time, if you'd asked me what the big climate risks are, and not just me, if you'd asked a random person in the climate expert world, we would have talked about loss of crops or flooding from sea level rise or extreme storms and heat. But we wouldn't have seen heat as that big. And I want to give you a very short summary of some really kind of amazing research by many different authors over maybe the last decade or so that really has quantified using epidemiological methods how bad heat is. So I'll actually show two slides, the webinar version. This is just a particular paper, Gasparini et al. There's lots of versions of this. What this shows you, I chose one with Toronto. What this shows you is the relative change in the absolute mortality, number of people who die every day in Toronto normally, as a function of temperature. And what you see, which is very common, is you see a low point, which is defined as one here, and then at high temperatures, death rate goes up, and at low temperatures, death rate goes up. You see it for Sao Paulo, Brazil there, and right away, you know, if you're a Canadian, you might feel proud that we're pretty cold adapted. So the point is, on a cold day in Toronto, deaths don't go up much, and a cold day in Brazil, actually, deaths go up a lot. But that hot peak really goes up steeply in different places. And you know, that's an increase of like a 50% increase in deaths. This is, there's all sorts of sort of powerful stats behind this. I won't go into it, but these are state-of-the-art data and models to really pull out the heat signature here. Let's see if I can move one slide down. This slightly more complicated graph shows you predictions using that data and using climate models for how the total a change in all-cause mortality might change in different locations under different warming scenarios in different times. So I just want you to pull out two things. One is northern countries actually benefit. So if you look at northern Europe has deaths declining due to less cold deaths, and that is about as big as the increase in heat deaths, even out to really bad climate scenarios. But say Southeast Asia, that number goes up to sort of 10% increase in excess mortality. And I want to say a little bit about what that is. COVID in the U.S., which managed it really badly, that was about a 15% increase in excess mortality. So the way to think about that is that would be late this century, a COVID every year. And of course, it would jump around a lot. So that means some years it would be many, many COVIDs. A few other really startling facts, to me anyway. One is, what I found is just an amazing study. I'm probably in this cohort. It was all America, or a huge chunk of America, 20 million or so. They were in this retrospective study born between about 1960 and the late 70s. And this study pulled out of this amazing noisy data that one extra day above 32 centigrade during the first trimester of pregnancy reduces your income at age 30 by $50. I mean, what a weird factoid. That's 0.1% reduction in your earning potential for every single degree. So 2 days would be 0.2%. And as a little less than the second trimester of pregnancy, these things just show correlation. Nobody knows what it is, but it's probably brain damage. There's now an immense amount of data showing that economic activity scales with heat. So a year that's a degree warmer than normal, a degree Fahrenheit in this case, shows India reducing its economic growth by 17%. So growth was reduced by 17% compared to normal, whereas Sweden goes up by 22%. And that's the Burke et al. Paper in Science. There's a lot of versions of that. But this is a big deal. This says that heat and variation of heat is a significant explainer in the relative economic growth rates of the hot world and the cool world. Big deal. And finally, one last one on a specific number from my dear friend Jason Park, who's been a young leader in doing this work and has looked in detail at New York City schools and now some schools in poor countries. And even in New York City schools, in a rich world place, surprisingly, lots of schools aren't air conditioned, not the poorer ones. And a hot year, a year that's kind of one standard deviation hot, is about as bad as having a one or even a little more than one standard deviation bad teacher. It's a really big impact. And that's presumably if you believe that teaching teaches you something that you take away for your life, that's a lifelong impact of heat. So I'm going to end there and just say that there really is this all sorts of data that suggests that heat is potentially a dominant human impact of climate change, far exceeding late this century impacts from, say, flooding or air pollution or changing in crops. I don't think we know that for sure, but I think people are really waking up to the idea. It may be the big thing.
Radio EcoShock. With David Keith, note the similarity between long-haul COVID. There is also a long-haul heat damage among survivors, and Jeff addresses this too. Keep in mind, heat mortality numbers are only immediate heat stroke deaths, and these are wildly underreported. The death certificates may list stroke or other causes, but those causes all spike because of the heat wave. And there is mortality in the weeks and months afterwards that never make the news. The least understood long-term effects of extreme heat are brain damage and changes to babies in the womb. Chronic kidney disease after extreme heat is also well known. Let's go back to that Energy versus Climate podcast number 24, released November 4th, 2021. Author Jeff Goodall explains how humans die during extreme heat.
What happens when your body's trying to deal with heat, your inner body temperature starts rising, and your heart says, okay, we got to get rid of this heat. So what it does is it starts pumping the blood towards your skin, shunting your blood out towards your skin so that it can be picked up by the sweat, the heat can be picked up by your sweat glands and dissipated out in sweat. And it works really hard to do that. And the hotter it gets, the harder it works to do that. And one of the things that starts happening is, first of all, if you have a heart problems in any way, any kind of heart-related issues, that's a big strain on your heart. So a lot of elderly people who are at risk for other things, the first thing that happens is they have heart attacks in hot weather. But the second thing that starts happening is that if you start pushing so much blood towards your skin, that it steals your some of your inner organs start being basically blood-deprived. And the proteins in your liver, in your intestines and other things start breaking down. And so your heart is racing, your temperature is rising, your inner organs are starting to freak out because they don't have blood. And then if things keep going, once you get to 102, 103, 104 degrees, depending on different people and things, these organs in your body start literally breaking down and they start leaking like intestinal fluid into your body cavity and things like that. And you go into what amounts to a kind of septic shock and you die. And so what kind of happens is that the cellular membrane in your body, when it gets to a certain level, literally melts. And these membranes in your internal organs start to just fall apart and your body disassembles itself. And so that's the sort of, you know, brief picture of what heat does to one's body. And it's important to say that people have different vulnerabilities depending on their general health and things. But this 35°C limit, wet bulb globe temperature, is pretty universal. And if you're out in that kind of hot, humid heat, but that also shows why dry desert heat and things like that is much more tolerable, because you don't have the problem of it's much easier to evaporate sweat and dissipate heat in dry, hot weather than it is in wet, hot weather. Mm-hmm. So is that a good?
Yeah, absolutely. And I wanted to better understand and maybe coming back to one of David's points. So there's heat stroke leading to death. That is an obvious risk and it's been much covered. But perhaps what do we understand around what he was talking to, some of the longer term impairments or injuries or illnesses? You know, he'd mentioned the correlation between exposure to heat in the womb and reduced income later in life. So what do we know about those who take an injury and unfortunately carry with them for the rest of their lives, and that impairs all sorts of other parts of their lives?
It does, and that's something that there's a lot of ongoing research about. And
you know, one thing to say about that is that, you know, these heat mortality numbers that David cited and that are widely cited are only basically immediate heat stroke deaths. These are deaths that happen, you know, within the time frame of the heat waves and things. And it's very well understood that, first of all, there's a lot of mortality in the weeks and months afterwards due to heart stresses and things like that. And there's also a lot of like long-term, risks. Some of the ones you talk about with what happens in your sort of brain with learning and things like that are the least understood. But what is some of the things that are really well understood is, for example, kidney damage, chronic kidney disease, because of what I talked about earlier about the sort of blood being pulled away from internal organs and the cellular membranes of the organs actually breaking down. That is particularly damaging to your kidney, to the many tiny pathways in your kidneys. And so I was just reading a study the other day about an estimate over the last decade in just in El Salvador and Guatemala of 20,000 deaths related to heat caused to kidney disease caused by extreme heat. So it has all these sort of knock-on effects that, you know, we haven't even begun to calculate.
Gotcha. And so 20,000, I remember back in 2003, there was a heat wave in Europe that killed 70,000 people. And then heat kills more people in the United States than anything else weather-related on an annual basis. But what do we understand about the extent of the risk? Yeah, I made reference to Kim Stanley Robinson's book and the first chapter, the harrowing chapter and, frankly, by now infamous first chapter. I know that I read it, and once you've read it, you can't unread it. It sticks in your brain. And for those who haven't looked at it, it talks about a scenario of, I think it's 20 million Indians dead over the span of a week or two. Are we looking at that type of risk, the extent of that kind of risk in the near future? What do we understand about it?
Well, Stan is a very good writer and he has a very vivid imagination. I think that may be a little beyond the pale of what we're thinking about right now. But I think that the heat mortality risks are widely underestimated. And, you know, even these numbers that we're citing about how many people died in the Pacific Northwest, you know, heat is notoriously sort of difficult to diagnose because you have all these other things like heart attacks and things that don't show up on death certificates. But, you know, there's a study now that estimates global heat deaths right now at over 300,000 a year. It was just published in The Lancet. So, you know, we're looking at massive amounts of deaths, especially as we get closer to these thermal limits. You're seeing it in, you know, regions that are like India, Pakistan, where you have in the Middle East, where you have very high temperatures combined with high humidity. You know, and one of the things about heat that is really important to understand about mortality is it's predatory. Mm-hmm. It goes after vulnerable people. It's like, you know, what wolves do to packs. You know, it goes after people who are outdoors, who don't have air conditioning, who are ill, who are elderly, who are very young, you know, people who are, you know, in any way don't have access to the simple things, right? I mean, as you pointed out in the intro, a heat wave is not so bad if you're sitting, you know, in a Harvard classroom and you've got air conditioning and a bottle of Evian water sitting next to you. It's like, oh, wow, it's 110 degrees out there. That's really hot. That's not a problem.
Right. Some drive-by slam of
yeah. He's nice, David. We'll grant him one drive-by slam.
No, but it's true. You know, I mean, it really is a, you know, there's a lot of talk right now in Glasgow about climate justice. It's the big, it's what's tearing that conference apart right now. That's the most difficult issue to deal with. And heat is the most vivid embodiment of that, because if you're a privileged person and you have air conditioning and you have a reliable electricity and you can afford to pay your bills, you know, you're going to be okay. But, you know, there's a lot of people who don't. And I've done a lot of reporting around the world already on this. And, you know, it's not just, you know, people in Pakistan. It's people in, you know, in Phoenix who live in mobile homes that are like tin boxes that are really, really hot. And can't afford to pay their electric bill and think that, oh, if I just turn the AC on for half an hour a day, I'll be okay. And they're not. They die. And, you know, so
it really maps to this larger climate justice question more than sort of any other of the climate impacts, I think.
Yeah. And I'd like to get you to tell the story of Sebastian Perez, because you've written about them. But I'll preface that with I've got some information from BC that's kind of hot off the presses, if you will. And I want to give a thank you to Sarah Henderson, who is with the BC Center for Disease Control. And they've looked at the deaths coming from the heat dome in that province in late June and early July of this year. And the short story in terms of risk factors is some of what you would expect. The risk factors, if you're isolated, if you're mentally ill, especially schizophrenia, if you're dependent on substances, you are at higher risk than those without. And the protective factors are privilege and green space. So to that correlation between the link between income and land surface temperature, in other words, neighborhoods have less, there are poor neighborhoods of less green spaces, and therefore they are warmer than richer neighborhoods. So their inhabitants are more at risk. But Jeff, could you tell us the Sebastian Perez story?
Sure. So during the heat wave that hit Pacific Northwest, you know, I was looking for a way to tell the story about this. And you know, as a journalist, I always look for sort of human stories to tell to make it something beyond numbers and graphs. And I heard about the death of a farm worker in a field in Willamette County, in the Willamette Valley, I mean, in Oregon, outside of Portland. And so I went out there and reported the story of what happened to him. And it's a classic story about who's vulnerable in this kind of a situation where we have, you know, these extreme heat waves. And he was a Guatemalan migrant. He came across the border about 3 months earlier to work in nursery in the Willamette Valley. He was married. He wanted to have children. He wanted to build a house for his wife and for his family in Guatemala, and there was no hope of making money to do that there. So he made the journey across, had some relatives who were working in the Willamette Valley, got him a job at this nursery. And, you know, he'd only been there a few months and, you know, was working out in a field. He was one of the field hands. On this particular day, there had been heat warnings. People knew the heat was coming. He knew the heat was coming. He had been in Guatemala. He's not a stranger to heat. And that day, he volunteered to work carrying, moving irrigation pipes around. And we don't know exactly what happened, but what we know is that, you know, at noon, he had been working all morning, sweating hard, went off to do some stuff in the field by himself. And at 3 o'clock or 3:30 was found by his coworkers dead in the field. And, you know, it's a classic case of, you know, heat exertion, causing, you know, the risk of a heat stroke to rise. There was no shade access to him. You know, their farm worker protections are very, shall we say, not robust, on this. He had access to water. But it brings up, you know, there's two things that I think kind of lessons from it, or there's many, but two things to point out. One is that there's a common idea that if you have access to water, you're going to be okay with heat. And that's just not true. What access to water gives you is it's important to have water in your system in order to not dehydrate so you can stop sweating. But you can easily die of heat stroke in 20 minutes or 30 minutes, no matter how hydrated you are. So that's one thing. The other thing is that there's a notion that people who live in hot climates are better acclimated to it. That if you live in a place like Guatemala, you can handle heat. Or if you live in the Philippines, you can handle heat. But that's just not true. We're all about the same. We can acclimate if you come to a new place for, you know, six weeks. Marathoners do this. You can make some incremental changes in your heat tolerance. But beyond that, there's no difference between anybody, whether they grew up in the Philippines, whether they grew up in Toronto. And so he was an example of that also. And, you know, the last thing I'll say about it is that, you know, as David pointed out in the intro, there's been a new realization about the risks of heat. This is something that people haven't really thought about, despite the fact that climate change was known as global warming for a long time. And we all know, we talk about heat all the time. The real heat risks to our bodies and to workers has not really been thought about. And it's particularly not been thought about for people, on the margins, like farm workers, where only two states right now have any kind of heat rules at all about workers, whether they're farm workers or warehouse workers or anyone else. OSHA is working on some now. Gina McCarthy has been a big advocate of sort of pushing for this, but there, it's really, the sort of Wild West for workers on this.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. We are listening to a new Energy versus Climate podcast on extreme heat, and we will be right back.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
We return to the Energy versus Climate podcast number 24, asking the big question, is heat the greatest climate threat? Host Ed Whittingham, along with scientist David Keith and guest Jeff Goodall, checks reaction from co-host Dr. Sarah Hastings Simon from the University of Calgary.
Sarah, you want to get in?
Yeah, just a couple of thoughts on that. Maybe one on that, on your last point about sort of the impact of heat. And I think that is, to me, that's another example of sort of the challenge that we have understanding these kinds of threshold effects, right? We sort of like all have this very linear mindset. And if you move along a heat curve, it's a little bit hotter and a little bit more uncomfortable. And, you can pull up lots of other examples of not understanding kind of, nonlinear growth. And I think this to me would be another one where it's like, it's sort of defies your, intuition that if it gets a little bit hotter, somehow you're going to go from being able to cope to all of a sudden being dead. And so that's maybe just a little bit thought of where that comes from. But I also wanted to come back to, on this topic of environmental justice and sort of it is, I think, getting more attention, and that's good. I think it's still sort of layered on top rather than really being fundamentally integrated. But I think we also have to acknowledge that, for the last, 20 years of discussions around addressing climate, it was very much focused on this like cost equation and what's the cost of addressing climate. And there was, essentially in many cases, absolutely no consideration of the costs of not addressing climate. Right. And I think that's a big part of what has gotten us to this point. And one could probably trace back where that comes from. And as we're saying, the people that were in the room having these discussions and the economists that were publishing on, here's the cost, aren't the ones that are out in the fields without access to air conditioning. So I think that, it's not hard to see where these things may have happened. But I think also, even where they are included, it's sort of people consider the costs in terms of, human life, but also in terms of what you would have to do to adapt to climate as being somehow harder to measure or, they don't fit within our frameworks. And I think that that's, to me, is a big warning about, where we can end up with this sort of desire to, quantify everything and say that this is what it will cost if we try to reduce emissions. And then the other side of the ledger is a bit messy because it's, frankly, it's just more complicated. So I think that obviously in some sense, some of that is too late, for the people that experienced this in BC and in other parts of the world this summer. But I do think that there is something that we can take from that going forwards of just how important it is to do the hard work of integrating costs and thinking about things that don't fit neatly within the analytical tools that we have today, and that, failure to do so is quite literally deadly.
Yeah. There's been some work even up here. The Canadian Institute for Climate Choices did a study, was released recently, and it predicted that extreme heat would cause an annual loss of 128 million work hours in Canada, and it's going to cost the economy $15 billion. Now they're projecting that by the end of the century. So who knows with these forecasts, but it's an attempt to quantify it. What I'd like to know, we're seeing some effort to quantify the labor cost. Jeff, what do you know about the cost of things like infrastructure?
So you get extreme heat, you get roads buckling, you get power grids failing. And then, of course, that compounds the human cost, especially of those who have a power grid goes down, those who need air conditioning in order to stay healthy during a heat wave. What do we know about the risk to infrastructure from heat?
That's a great subject. There's not been a lot of, you know, good sort of work that really quantifies that I've come across. I mean, it's something that I'm exploring in the book, and that certainly what we all saw in the Pacific Northwest with, you know, as you talk about roads buckling, and I was talking just the other day to a head of a big utility out there who was talking about, you know, the problem of power lines sagging, reduced capacity of power lines as they heat up. They can't carry as much current. They sag down. They're more likely to hit trees, torch wildfires. You know, there's this sort of cascading effect of this stuff. And, you know, in Phoenix, they'd had to stop flights because the runway was too soft because of the heat for the planes to land and take off. You know, our infrastructure has thermal limits also. You know, we built our world for this sort of Goldilocks zone that we've been living in, right? And we're moving out of the Goldilocks zone. And that has implications for me and for you. It has implications for our airports, our runways, our power system, and of course, for the ecosystem more broadly around us. You know, and this is a very sort of, you know, idea that's so big, it's sort of hard to kind of hold in your head, this notion of this Goldilocks zone, that everything that we build and live with is acclimated to a certain temperature. And that, you know, obviously things can live in really hot environments, and, you know, bacteria live in the hot springs and in Yellowstone and deep thermal vents. Things can live in very cold things, but that's not what they're built to live in. There's not their, you know, their Goldilocks zone is different than our Goldilocks zone. And so our whole world is moving out of this. And one of the things I'm trying to do in this book is quantify that and talk about that and show that it's not, the human mortality is only just one small piece of this larger change of rising heat.
Of course, I think it's politically, we don't say it because we all want climate action, but of course the whole world isn't moving out of it. That's part of the lesson you get from Burke and all these different studies, is that in fact there are economic benefits to the cooler countries. And I think that hasn't kind of entered into the politics. I think one of my questions is, when will it? Like, and I haven't looked at the study you cited about Canadian heat loss, but I wonder if that was a deliberately political study that only cited the hot side. Like that graph I showed at the beginning shows the hot side and the cold side, and all these analysis use both. And that's why you get an overall benefit in Sweden, economic benefit from a little bit warmer. And my guess is the same is true in Canada, but people just don't want to say it because, of course, we all want climate action. But I think my question for Jeff is, in what point is the stark reality that in crude economic terms, if these studies are right, that in fact some northern countries are, you know, it's a wash or maybe even a small benefit to get somewhat warmer, whereas it's horrifically bad for the hottest countries?
Yeah.
David, maybe just one twist to add on that for Jeff to answer too, because this is actually not clear to me, is like in those studies, how does time to adapt the infrastructure, as Jeff was talking about, get taken into account there, right? Because I think that much like the, you know, organisms that have adapted to live places and how we have built our world, those previously temperature changes were much slower and they took much longer and they were more, you know, they took place over the times that were the time of evolution of animals, or at least of movement of their habitat, and certainly over the time of, you know, the infrastructure, say, of building a house. Now, you know, as we saw in a place like Calgary last summer, you know, people were very uncomfortable in the summer here because many of them don't have air conditioners. Now, of course, you can say there is, if you have the money, an answer there, but adapting those living places takes time. So I guess I wonder also then in those studies that show sort of the potential advantage of the warming, is that still true if you consider, you know, the short time period over which that happens and therefore that we have to adapt our infrastructure and the cost that adaptation takes?
The studies fundamentally look at year-to-year variations in GDP compared to year-to-year variations in temperature. And because the adaptation is baked in, so the point is even Sweden, I'm speaking of that because we look at the data, even Sweden is a coal country. So it's done its adaptation, but it's still true relatively that the Swedish GDP grows faster on a year that's a little bit warmer, whereas the Indian GDP grows slower on a year that's warmer.
So this, I think, is all true, but I think that, you know, we humans are not good. We're good at talking about this kind of stuff, you know, in seminars like this. But when it comes to actually happening in real time, you know, no one's going to notice, oh, the Corn Belt has moved, you know, 10 miles north or 15 miles north. I mean, all this stuff is going to happen, you know, in its own kind of way. And, you know, COVID and the history of climate response has shown anything is that we're not very good at, you know, thinking ahead about how to deal with this kind of stuff. And to the point that, you know, it's going to be good for some places, you know, that's certainly true. I mean, wheat and corn will grow farther north in Canada than it does now. There's a lot of studies showing the Corn Belt moving north, right? I mean, there's going to be a lot of changes that way. But, you know, if anything, this heat wave in the Pacific Northwest shows, you know, how vulnerable places that they think are safe are, right? I mean, the problem in Pacific Northwest was that nobody had air conditioning. You know, I think the penetration in Seattle was 20% or something, and nobody was thinking about it. Nobody was prepared for it. Some of my friends here, I'm in Austin, Texas, and some of my friends here, you know, half joking, half serious, point out that, oh, people in Washington and British Columbia just don't know how to handle heat. They don't know what to do. And, you know, that's kind of a callous thing to say, but it is kind of true, right? And so, I mean, no one's going to get out free in this, right? And this notion that it's going to be good for the north and bad for the equatorial, you know, tropics and things is true, but it's also going to accelerate all of these climate justice questions and things. You know, when you have a heat wave that kills 75,000 people in Pakistan and causes huge unrest in, I mean, God knows there's, you know, India, Pakistan is not a sort of tranquil region of the world. You know, what are the implications of that? What are the national security implications of that? What, how do we as moral humans think about that? Right. So it's a really complex, you know, equation.
Yeah. It reminds me, and on a COP note, Glasgow is happening now. I was at the Cancun COP in 2010, and I remember taking in a presentation by senior military brass across the U.S. forces. And the simple message was climate change is real. It poses real threats to American security, sort of following along Wynne Dyer's climate wars thesis. You disrupt precipitation in Mexico, that could cause an illegal immigration or refugee crisis or exacerbate the existing crisis. And we can do something proactively about it, or we can do something retroactively about it and, you know, go in and basically take care of these conflicts once they've happened. But I, you know, getting back to air conditioners, you know, there's a big difference in heat deaths under that heat dome between British Columbia and Oregon, because in Oregon, you have more air conditioners than you do in BC. And to Sarah's point, we haven't thought that we've actually needed them. That is, to be clear, a solution. Air conditioning can protect people, but it's a very expensive one, and it's going to put further stress on our already stressed electricity grids, which, as we talked about earlier, may be more stressed through an extreme heat event. So to pivot now a little bit from the doom and gloom side, and yes, Mom and Energy versus Climate listeners, my mom is a loyal listener, and she said, is this episode going to be really depressing? And I said, I hope not, because we're going to end on a positive note before we take questions. So to pivot, like what can we do, Jeff, beyond just trying at exorbitant cost to install a bunch of air conditioners around the world?
Well, the good thing about heat mortality, as we've been talking about it, is, you know, that it's a very preventable. I mean, it's, you know, obviously things like air conditioning, I strongly reject the notion that heat's not a problem because we can just buy everybody air conditioners and all that. You know, we have 800 million people in the world who don't even have electricity, much less air conditioning, right? So the idea that we're just going to buy everybody air conditioners is not a solution. But there are a lot of solutions, you know, and there are a lot of things that can hugely reduce the risk of heat. Planting shade trees, you know, just having, you know, more green spaces in our world. having better social outreach so that, you know, your aunt who has a heart murmur is not alone in her apartment when it's 107 degrees. You know, having, you know, there's a lot of push from people like the Red Cross and others to have these heat activation networks that really try hard to mobilize the network of people to make sure that people are not alone during this and that they understand the risks. They have access to water and things like that. And they don't think, oh, I'm just going to tough this out. I'll be fine. It's not going to get that hot. I'll be fine. So, you know, compared to things like, you know, sea level rise, for example, which is not a huge, you know, nobody dies from sea level rise directly. You don't stand on the beach and water rises and you drown, right? I mean, you can increase storms and things like that. But, you know, sea level rise has enormous financial implications because you have all this built infrastructure on the coast and all that kind of thing. Heat mortality is not like that, right? This is relatively plastic. We can do a lot. We can change how buildings are insulated. We can change, you know, we can plant trees. We can do these social activation of things. So I actually think it's a very kind of, I mean, the problems go to the larger economic problems of the economic divide, having prosperity, people be able to pay electric bills, things like that. You know, the larger economic inequalities are a big driver in this, but there's really a lot that can be done in a very immediate, direct, you know, it's going to be hot next weekend. Let's make sure we don't have 70,000 people dying here. You know, I mean, I think that it's very hopeful in that sense.
I want to point to an example that I learned about when I was in Bangladesh a year and a half ago, which is not about adaptation to heat, but I think it tells you about how powerful knowing that something's going to happen and responding in a planned way can be. So the Bangladesh monsoon in the around 1970, 71, during the war that formed the country, was by many measures the worst natural disaster of human history. So it killed something like 500,000 people. There was another monsoon of similar storm surge with similar intensity about a decade ago. I forget the exact date. And it killed about 500 people, which I don't mean to minimize, but a much smaller number. And that was fundamentally because cell phone-based warning systems and a planned decision that when people are warned, they get into shelters, which are mostly schools, because you only have to get a few meters higher and you're not going to die. It's not fun, but you're not going to die. And that's really dramatic. And my sense is it actually would be possible, it cost and reasonable, to do some of the same things for heat. So you could have shelters over air conditioned and you could have obviously engineer those shelters to have much more stable, much more higher probability air conditioner won't fail than the regular power grid. You can obviously do white roofs. There's a bunch of things. And the social thing that Jeff mentioned turns out to be a big deal. Getting old people out of the social network that gets an old people out of the old person out of the top floor of a building can be a big deal. If you say British Columbia with the same technology, had we had the social system in place already that says if it's getting really hot, you check on your neighbors. And if one Sally has air conditioner, the other neighbors go to Sally's house on a super hot day. Those things can actually make a big deal. So I actually think there's a lot of room for adaptation if we know that there's a problem that we act in a coherent way and solve it. I mean, obviously, the biggest way to do is to cut emissions. Just assume we all know that.
Right.
Yeah, and I think the political will has to be there. And there is examples. You know, I think that France was a place that saw a lot of deaths in that 2003 heat wave. And they did, I think, prepare better and did fare better by doing a lot of the things that you're mentioning, David, around having, you know, people check on elderly neighbors and also have kind of more centralized cooling centers. So I think certainly there's a piece to work on there. I mean, I do think it's worth, you know, just underscoring again the emissions reduction side of things, right? Because that is, you know, I guess I personally maybe don't spend a lot of time thinking about these kind of heat challenges and what that means and spend more time just thinking about how we have to reduce emissions. But it is a little bit sobering, again, to hear, you know, and think about really the challenges that sit behind there. But I think that on a practical level, you know, it means that we have to continue and accelerate our efforts on emissions reduction, but it also means that we need to find ways to integrate these adaptation questions, I think, across all of the things that we're doing on the policy side as well, too, and the development side as well, too. And so, you know, to specific examples of that, I mean, there's a lot of interest in How do we manage a grid to integrate more variable renewables? And one way to manage the, you know, variability that I think we've talked about previously is this idea of demand side management, right? And, you know, using financial tools to get people to use electricity at different times of the day. But, you know, when we start talking about getting to temperatures where access to electricity really becomes a question of, you know, impacting mortality, I think we have to be very careful as we're designing these kinds of systems and really think about what is the basic, especially in a warmer world, what is the basic level of access to electricity and to cooling systems that is sort of, you know, really necessary for sustaining life, that we have to make sure that, you know, whatever electricity time shifting mechanisms we're using, you know, respects that and doesn't get people to just switch off their air conditioning or their fans over 3 days when it's hot because they simply can't afford it. I think the flip side of that is, you know, there are also some technological options there, and actually moving the generation and or the consumption of electricity for cooling is something that you can do across a day in even relatively simple ways, right? There's like both everything from pre-cooling buildings to getting a little bit more complicated and doing things like making ice within big chillers that are then used during the hottest part of the day to provide the air conditioning. So there's a lot of what I would call, you know, that it's not even quite high tech. It's like mid tech tools that are there. But our markets, our electricity systems aren't set up, you know, to do that. And so I think that's something that we need to work on as well. And of course, I have to bring out heat pumps because now I am officially sponsored and I got a free t-shirt that said, "Hi, I love heat pumps." Which doesn't actually impact my view of them. But that's another area where you say, okay, well, if everybody's going to be rushing to install air conditioners, what do we do to make sure that they at least install a heat pump instead, right? And if the marginal cost of that is relatively small, you know, is that a place where regulation should come in? Because it's, we've been having this discussion, I think, on Twitter over the last week or so. But, you know, even if you want to have a heat pump installed in your home in Calgary, it's pretty hard to find someone who will do it. You'll find a lot of people tell you it makes no sense whatsoever, you know, in any reason. So I think those are the kinds of things that are, it's tricky because we're trying to solve a number of problems at the same time when you talk about climate mitigation, adaptation, and equality issues. And so that's a lot harder in a sense on the policy side than just solving one of those. But of course, it also, you know, is a big opportunity because if you can get things right, then you manage to address a number of those challenges at the same time and in probably a more efficient way.
That's great. And I love heat pumps. T-shirts available at sarahhastingssimon.com.
I'm just in it for the t-shirts. Yes,
there are some basics here, and it's not high tech, it's low tech. Better ventilation in Amazon warehouses, for instance. I personally, back in my early 30s, had a summer job building split unit air conditioners for Matsushita in Japan on an assembly line. It's building air conditioners in a building with no air conditioning in the middle of the Japanese summer. So I've experienced the inanity personally. But I wonder, and to an earlier point, emergency response preparation, we just have to get better. And BC, in our case, was caught flat-footed. A fire station chief called her parents during the middle of that heat dome and said, if you think you're at risk of heat stroke and you're getting sick, don't call 911 because you might not get through, or in one case you'll wait 17 minutes. Go seek help directly. That is clearly a system level failure if that happens. But I wonder, Jeff, before we turn to audience Q&A, is there something, do we just need like a UN declaration that no one should die from heat? Like is that part of it?
Well, that's an interesting idea. Heavy emphasis on the should in that sentence. But yeah, I mean, I do think that, but of course saying no one should die from heat means like, okay, well, how do you deal with the just gaping, you know, economic inequalities that make people victims to heat? So it's unfortunately, it's sort of like a, morally a great proclamation, that, you know, when you begin to think about how do we implement that, gets very complicated very quickly, right? And so, you know, dealing with heat is is just wound up with dealing with all kinds of other things like health insurance, like well-paying, decent-paying jobs. You know, I think you can make a strong argument that, raising the minimum wage or a higher basic minimum wage would do more to help people, deal with extreme heat than almost anything.
A reminder, this episode is going to be available at our site, energyversusclimate.com. It's going to be available as a podcast, an Apple Podcast, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever else you listen. Wherever you do listen, rate us. That really helps. Our next episode is going to come out in a couple weeks' time. It's actually going to be about careers in low-carbon energy. It'll be a different format, so we're looking forward to it. I hope you enjoy it. Give us feedback at energyversusclimate@gmail.com.
What I haven't actually seen is a paper that investigates the probability of the Kim Stanley Robinson scenario. So I showed you a paper that showed you average all-cause mortality going up 10% to Southeast Asia, which is huge. But there's going to be a huge amount of variability around that. And I don't know what the probability of the Kim Stanley Robinson 20 million event is in later this century. I mean, maybe over to Jeff more to sort of speculate about it. Really, to me, especially what all this means, how it changes the politics of this topic.
That's an interesting question about how it changes the politics of the topic. I mean, there's lots of studies showing that as, average temperatures increase, the extremes increase also, right? The sort of bell curve moves farther, to the right. Whether a Kim Stanley Robinson scenario can happen, I mean, that's just there's so many variables in that, and depending on what the temperature is and where it is. I mean, I think that is clearly, it would take something that's really, really extreme, that beyond our capacity, I think, of even the most sort of any climate modeler that I know, to get the kind of heat wave that would kill that many people in a place like India right now. But we are moving in that direction, right? I mean, we are moving in that direction because we are moving into a world where right now in parts of Pakistan, you have, I think this year there were 12 days a year that were above the 35°C wet bulb globe temperature that I mentioned before. And 6 years ago, there was one. And, the movement in this direction is clear. So as we get more and more of these days where you're above the human threshold, then you're going to get, sort of more and more deaths and more harvesting. But I think the interesting question that we haven't really talked about, David, you brought up a little bit, is this question of how it changed politics. I mean, especially in the context of COVID, where we're dealing with, how has all these deaths that, we've all been witnessing in real time changed the politics of our response to COVID and how we think about pandemics? It's not hard to conceive of a heat wave that kills 100,000 people in India or Pakistan or somewhere, Iran or somewhere like that, somewhere that's very vulnerable. Do we care? I mean, honestly, do we in the West, the people who make policy, care? I mean, I don't know. It's interesting what the sort of human threshold is for like death and like how that changes politics. And it's a crude question, but especially in the context of COVID, it's one that's worth asking.
That happened in his book. And again, it's a work of fiction, but what really got the U.S. moving in his book was heat deaths in the U.S. and on an order of magnitude less than what had happened in that harrowing opening chapter to India in the book.
That is all the time we have for this special podcast on the grave danger of extreme heat as the world warms. You can find episode 21 at energyvsclimate.com or on YouTube, search for Is Heat the Greatest Climate Threat? You can get it on Spotify and all the rest. Of course, I will put links to the show on my blog, too. My thanks to Whittington, Hastings, Simon, and Keith for getting this key information out there for the rest of us. Jeff Goodall says the Lancet estimates over 350,000 deaths a year already. Heat is predatory, like wolves in packs. It goes after the poor, the very young or the old, and the weak with pre-existing conditions. The rich can adapt where the poorest cannot. So heat is the most vivid embodiment, as Jeff says, of climate justice or injustice, a hot topic at the recent COP26. It looks like hundreds of millions of people could either die of heat or be driven out of their homes as climate migrants during your lifetime. Watch this space.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website, We're at ecoshock.org.
Heat waves in 2003, there was a heat wave in Europe that killed over 60,000 people. Over 60,000 people died in 2 weeks.